It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Muslim community in Wisconsin is still reeling from the arrest of Salah Sarsour, the president of the Islamic Society of Milwaukee.
Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents arrested him last week, with the Department of Homeland Security claiming Sarsour lied on immigration forms in the 1990s and that he's a foreign policy threat suspected of funding terror organizations.
His supporters believe his arrest was politically motivated because of his pro-Palestinian activism. Sarsour has lived in the U.S. for over 30 years.
Sarsour has been held in an Indiana detention center. He's scheduled to have a hearing in Chicago Immigration Court next week.
We're checking in on the latest in his case and its impact on his community. Othman Atta is executive director of the Islamic Society of Milwaukee. Othman, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you very much.
Where is Salah Sarsour being held at this moment? What do you know about his current condition?
Well, he's being held in the Clay Detention Center. It's in Brazil, Indiana, not too far from Terre Haute, Indiana. And initially, he was having some problems with, not being provided some of his basic needs. I heard that this weekend they finally brought some things that he had requested to him, such as underclothing and things like that, which he did not have when he was initially confined.
How much contact have you and other local leaders had with him in custody? How is he doing?
Look, he's in high spirits. He said, look, I'm going through this. He had been obviously jailed before by the Israelis unjustly when he was still a minor, and he was held by them for 2 years. And so he knows what it's like to be confined. He's always talked about how difficult it is to be confined. And so he sees this as part of the struggle after having lived here for over 32 years with an impeccable record. No charges ever were made against him, no convictions ever of anything. So he just sees this as part of the struggle, not just for himself, but for really the Muslim community, the Palestinian community, and Palestinians in general.
Othman, was there any indication that this arrest was coming? Had the Department of Homeland Security, had U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or any other law enforcement agency told him he was under investigation?
This came as a big surprise for him. Now, he knows that he has been targeted in the past because of his involvement with other organizations. Actually, not him directly, but the organizations, American Muslims for Palestine, and other organizations that their primary work is advocacy for Palestinians, exposing what Israel has been doing in Gaza and the West Bank. So he knows that those organizations have been targeted. And we found out recently that his name came up because they were trying to target him for part of this advocacy, which they tried to falsely tie to anti-Semitism. And that was something that apparently the Department of Homeland Security has been working on for months.
Sarsour is scheduled to have a hearing in Chicago Immigration Court next week. What will that hearing include? And do you expect it to happen on time as scheduled?
I don't think it will go on as scheduled. He is still working on putting together a legal team. I can tell you, though, that his attorneys had actually filed papers calling for his release. This is not in immigration court. This is actually in the federal district court. They actually have filed some documents. They filed a brief. And so they're trying to see if he can actually be released. In immigration court, unfortunately, because of the charges, and they're not actually charges, because of the allegations, in immigration court, these are not actual charges, but the information that they provided would actually require mandatory detention. And we believe that that's intentional. So one of the items that they used, for example, was what they used against Mahmoud Khalil, that if the Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, alleges that he is a threat to the foreign policy of the United States, then he could be detained. And again, without any kind of a bond. So here's a guy that's been in the United States for 32 years without any kind of record, negative record. And now all of a sudden, out of the blue, Marco Rubio decides that he's a threat to our foreign policy. It's not really our foreign policy he's a threat to, but apparently because the Israelis don't like what he happens to say, this is part of the problem.
Quickly, before I have to let you go, what do you think of these claims that DHS has made against him, including throwing a Molotov cocktail at the homes of Israeli armed forces and lying on immigration forms?
Well, I think all of those are actually false. I mean, even the allegation that he received in court didn't say that he had thrown Molotov cocktails at Israeli soldiers. It said that he threw a Molotov cocktail at the home of a collaborator. Again, this is in an Israeli military kangaroo court. This is what the Israelis are saying against a guy who was a minor more than 30-some years ago. Most Palestinians, unfortunately, are falsely accused. You could go to Israeli human rights groups such as B'Tselem. Other human rights groups will tell you that these claims always are coerced under torture, under interrogation. So absolutely, that's not true. And the allegations that he provided false information is the allegation when did he say that he was not arrested or was not in prison? He doesn't recognize his arrest and imprisonment as being legitimate. Again, it's all tied to something that happened when he was a minor and nothing afterwards.
Thank you so much for joining us, Othman.
Thank you for having me.
Othman Atta is executive director of the Islamic Society of Milwaukee. Now for a broader look at Sarsour's case and how it compares to other recent immigration detentions in Wisconsin and elsewhere, we turn to Mark Christopher, immigration attorney and owner of Christopher Law in Milwaukee. Mark, welcome back.
Good morning.
Sarsour is a prominent figure in the Wisconsin Muslim community. How common is the case against him that DHS is alleging?
Oh, it's extremely uncommon. I can tell you, I've been an immigration attorney for 16 years, and I've never encountered a case like this with these specific charges. I couldn't even point to one case in Wisconsin that I'm aware of. The only thing that that I've seen that's similar to this is what your previous guests had referenced of the student out east who had been charged with similar allegations.
The Columbia University student facing threat of deportation, Mahmoud Khalil.
Correct, yes.
Sarsour got his green card nearly 30 years ago now. Is it normal for immigration enforcement to look back that long after a person has been living in the country with no criminal issues?
It'd be extremely rare, unless there would be some reason for them to go back and look at it. And, you know, what people have to realize is in the immigration courts, they're administrative courts, and the Department of Homeland Security has to allege certain allegations that make one deportable. The most common is when somebody commits a crime or is convicted of a crime. This one is so unusual because it requires the Department of State, specifically the Secretary of State, to determine that someone is, quote, under the statute, a potential serious adverse foreign threat. And you just don't see that hardly at all in our work.
Mark, is there a legal standard for enforcing this allegation of being a foreign policy threat? How does that get proven in court?
Yeah, it's really so the statute is very, very vague. And that's the question that's going to come before the judge is what is a serious adverse foreign policy threat? And you have to balance that against our rights as Americans and having the First Amendment. I mean, simply saying something that is adverse should be protected by the First Amendment. So I think that they're going to have to show something beyond that, that, you know, someone has organized something against the U.S. government or has taken some type of affirmative action. But if someone holds or harbors certain beliefs or says certain words, that in and of itself should not meet that requirement.
In Salah Sarsour's case, he has received public support from some prominent Democratic politicians, Governor Evers for one, U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin, among others. Can public political pressure help in cases like this?
I think in most cases it does. I'd be curious to see how this administration takes it. In my kind of view and in watching this administration, it's almost kind of anything that you do against them, they dig in harder or maybe go further the other way. So, I mean, I would like to think that it would, but I'm not necessarily hopeful that it will.
And his status as a prominent community leader in Milwaukee, what impact does that have?
Well, I mean, that's the dangerous part of this case is, are you going to persecute or target people for what they believe, what they say in and of itself? And so I think that the motivation here is to try to quell people, outspoken people, against the foreign policy of the United States. And, you know, I think that's a dangerous slope. As an attorney, I feel like that's a slippery slope to go down.
Do non-citizens have First Amendment protections?
They do, absolutely. And again, that's why in this case, they would have to show that he has done something more, or they should have to show that he's done something more than just be outspoken against the current U.S. foreign policy. That in and of itself is protected speech. They'd have to say that he somehow undermined or organized or affirmatively have taken some action. And from what I've read, at least what I know, I don't see that.
Mark, thank you for joining us.
It's always a pleasure. Thank you.
Mark Christopher is an immigration attorney and owner of Christopher Law in Milwaukee. He was with us to share how the case against Islamic Society of Milwaukee President Salah Sarsour compares to other immigration arrests. And earlier, we heard from the Islamic Society's executive director, Othman Atta, about the latest in Sarsour's case. We reached out to DHS for an interview and didn't hear back.
Coming up, a federal program that helps low-income people get HIV medication and support services is under strain, leading Wisconsin and other states to limit services. What could that mean here in the state?
Community organizations already struggle to be able to consistently fund those programs and support all of the people who need them. I think those cuts would ultimately be pretty significant.
That's next on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Wisconsin is among at least 18 states that have taken steps to cut costs for its state HIV drug assistance program, a move that the state health department says will affect hundreds of people.
A report from KFF finds that states are taking steps like restricting eligibility and the scope of services.
These state programs are funded by the federal Ryan White HIV/AIDS program, first established in 1990 to help people with low income access medical care, medication, and support services for managing HIV.
Wisconsin's HIV drug assistance program serves roughly 1,500 clients a year and provides medication assistance for over 10,000 prescriptions annually. That's according to a 2024 estimate from the Department of Health Services.
Jen Cates joins us now. She's Senior Vice President at KFF and Director of the organization's Global and Public Health Policy Program, where she's been analyzing state cuts to AIDS drug assistance programs. Jen, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
It's good to be here.
Now, the HIV drug assistance program here in Wisconsin serves thousands of residents every year. Every state does something like this. Give us a sense, broad strokes, what do these programs do in states around the country?
Yeah, so in 1990, so quite a while ago, Congress passed something called the Ryan White Care Act, and it has set up a state-funded programs across the country that would provide AIDS treatments to people with HIV as well as other services in recognition that those services were expensive and states were really struggling to meet the needs. So right now, every state has set up what's called an AIDS drug assistance program. It's funded by the federal government, and states also put resources in. And they've basically been a lifeline to people with HIV across the country who otherwise would not be able to afford their medications.
You did an analysis for KFF and found a lot of states, including Wisconsin, are doing some kind of cost-cutting measures. What are the fiscal challenges facing states that they're having to look at cuts in the services they provide?
So we did this analysis because we were surprised to see that states, for the first time in many, many years, they were cutting back on the generosity of the program. They were restricting eligibility. And why are they doing that? Well, states are facing financial constraints. The economy writ large is pushing against states' own budgets. And that's not just specific to this program. It's a broader issue. In addition, there's some health financing pressures on states. We no longer have the ACA enhanced tax credits, so it's more expensive for people to get health insurance, and Medicaid is being cut back. So states are facing fiscal pressures in many, many different directions. And with that, they are having to look at the different programs they support or the federal government supports and say, what can we do to cut costs? What we saw was that many states, and actually 23 states, were either doing something like this to their ADAPs or considering cutting back, reducing eligibility, cutting back on the generosity of insurance purchasing, or other measures. But ultimately, all of these steps can affect access to HIV treatments.
Now, the state's Department of Health Services here in Wisconsin confirmed that they are making some of these changes. A bunch of maybe small things on their own that seem to add up to a lot. What do you see when you look at Wisconsin compared to how the other states in your analysis handled this?
Yeah, so the most dramatic state is not Wisconsin. It was Florida was where this really started, where Florida attempted to cut back on the income eligibility very dramatically and would end up cutting thousands of people out of the program. And that their legislature actually pushed back and passed an emergency measure to stop that from happening, at least temporarily. But other states like Wisconsin are doing other kinds of things. And Wisconsin is cutting back on one aspect of the program that's been really innovative and important, which is that ADAPs, in addition to purchasing outright AIDS medications, are also able by law to purchase insurance plans for people with HIV in the marketplace. And if you think about it, when you buy someone insurance, you're not only giving them access to their medications, but you're giving them access to, let's say, heart medication or any other health needs that they might have. And in fact, it's really cost effective. It's cheaper to buy health insurance for someone in the market than it is to buy just their medications. What Wisconsin is doing is cutting back on that program. And other states are doing that too. But it's going to mean that people with HIV are going to be faced with much more difficulty getting their AIDS meds because the marketplace, the health plans that are in all states, the costs of those are going up. So it's the most cost-effective way ADAPs can help, but it's also one that some states like Wisconsin are cutting back on.
Let's talk about the cost of HIV and AIDS treatment, especially those medications. I thought, well, maybe some of these have been around for a while. Costs might have come down over the decades. Well, hang on. Looking at the numbers, we're talking about some pretty expensive treatments here, right?
Yeah, we're talking about thousands of dollars, a year. And the costs haven't really come down in general. We've had great treatments. I mean, the difference is today, somebody with HIV could take one pill and be very healthy and have a normal lifespan. So they're incredible medications, but they cost. And so it is not something that someone who's – so let me just back up and say that the ADAP program is for those people with HIV who are uninsured. They don't have insurance or they have limited insurance. So it's for that group of people that really face financial hardship and would otherwise have their health suffer if they weren't able to get access to AIDS drugs through this program. But yes, the medications are out of reach of most people who don't have coverage.
One concern you write in the analysis is that people might end up on waiting lists for participating in these programs. What are we seeing? Is that something that's happening?
So right now, there's no state that has put in what they're calling a waiting list. And this was a problem that occurred a more than 10 years ago, and it got a lot of national headlines because the idea that people with HIV in the U.S. were waiting for their medications and couldn't get them was, pretty big deal. But what states are effectively doing, if they reduce eligibility, if they say, we're going to say we're taking down our income eligibility from 300% of FPL to 150% of the federal poverty, or we're taking out the insurance purchasing, they're effectively creating a waiting list that's not called a waiting list. So the next person who comes along and is wanting services might not be eligible. So there's no active waiting lists at this time, but there are these measures which are going to keep people out of the program. We're monitoring it, as are others, to see if states do end up imposing a wait list or taking harsher measures if this doesn't get resolved.
Another option, as opposed to cutting services and cutting costs, might be for a state or even the federal government to put more money into this kind of program. Wisconsin, at least for now, has a budget surplus. Not every state is in that same boat. Are you seeing moves at the state or federal level to say, okay, hey, this health coverage is more expensive, these drugs are more expensive, we should put more money into this program?
So years ago, when there were waiting lists, that there were a couple of different times when the federal government had to step in and provide emergency funding to try to address the problem. The federal government hasn't done that at this time. And what we're, states, putting Wisconsin aside, states generally haven't had surpluses and they have to balance their budgets. So maybe Wisconsin's in a better place if it wanted to reconsider. But what had happened in Florida, for example, when Florida was about to take a step that would kick thousands of people off of their program, this legislature passed an emergency measure to provide funding on a short-term basis to address it. But that's not a long-term solution either. So I think that's kind of where we're at, is states are having to make difficult decisions. But if a state does have a surplus, they could look at this situation and say, maybe we should not reduce access for people who are living with HIV.
And finally, Jen, at a very personal level, is this going to be a situation where somebody who last year was able, with this kind of help, to afford the AIDS HIV medication they need, it might be that in the months to come, they stop taking that medication if there's not a viable way to pay for it?
Yeah, so this is the real concern. So what Wisconsin's doing, for example, is they're saying effective January 1st, 2026, which we've already had, they're no longer providing the insurance assistance to new applicants. But starting next year, in a year, that's going to apply to all people who have been benefiting from the insurance tool that the state has been using. So there could be cases where people with HIV just facing the high cost of medications and the high cost of living might have to make a difficult choice and may not be able to afford their meds. And that would have dramatic impact on their health. And it could also affect the spread of HIV, since people with HIV who are on antiretrovirals and they have a suppressed viral load are not going to transmit HIV to somebody else. So keeping their viral load down and keeping them on AIDS meds is really important for their own health and for prevention.
Jen, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Jen Cates is Senior Vice President at KFF and Director of the organization's Global and Public Health Policy Program. Looking into local impacts here in Wisconsin now, Dr. Catherine Quinn joins us. She's Director of the Center for Community Health and Intervention Research at the Medical College of Wisconsin. Dr. Quinn, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
How big an impact do you see these Wisconsin restrictions to that HIV drug assistance program having on people here in the state?
We don't know exactly how many people will be impacted, but it could be significant. So there are about 7,600 people in Wisconsin living with HIV, and about 1,800 of them are on HDAP, the HIV drug assistance program in Wisconsin. So, the estimates suggest about 23% could be impacted by these changes.
And if someone ultimately is taken off of this program or might have been eligible in the past for new coverage and isn't able because of these changes, what are your concerns about the impact on their health care?
I think the biggest impact is what Jen just mentioned, which is that we know that when someone with HIV is on effective antiretroviral therapy and achieves what is known as viral suppression, so this means that the virus is reduced to undetectable levels in their blood, two things happen. One, the person's own health is dramatically protected and improved. But two, they can't transmit HIV to other people. So again, it's not just good for the individual, but this is a really great and significant public health achievement. And the numbers in Wisconsin bear this out. So statewide, about 81% of people in Wisconsin living with HIV are virally suppressed. But among people on HDAP, that number rises to 95%. And so this is a really incredible achievement that happens when people have access to HIV medications, when their insurance premiums are covered so that they don't drop their plans, and when there are case managers available to help them navigate the system and show up when life gets really complicated. And these numbers really highlight then the impact of programs like HDAP for us.
You've researched how various social and structural factors influence HIV prevention and treatment. In that research, where does this federal Ryan White program fit into the landscape of HIV prevention and treatment?
Yeah, I think one of the things that's really important to highlight is that Ryan White Part B funding not only provides that medication coverage, but it also funds a network of community agencies that provide things like case management, housing, mental health and substance use services, medical transportation. And these are support services that research consistently shows are essential to keeping people on treatment. So if someone is unhoused or can't get to the clinic or is in the middle of a mental health crisis, they're not able to stay on their medications, no matter how good those medications are, right? And so one of the concerns that we're seeing is that with the cuts in assistance to affording medications combined with the cuts to case management services, we can see a real large impact, not just on the medication, but also those social and structural factors that impact someone's ability to adhere to their medications. Housing, for example, is a really critical one. We know that unstable housing is one of the biggest factors that impact someone's ability to retain them or to stay in HIV care.
Since the 80s, the U.S., I think it's fair to say, has made a lot of progress when it comes to HIV in preventing the spread of the illness. And of course, the treatments we're talking about weren't available when HIV first broke out. How is it in some ways a victim of that success that people maybe aren't thinking of HIV and AIDS as a serious problem, even though obviously for people who have the disease, it still is?
Certainly. And I think that we in Wisconsin, we've, you know, been able to benefit from those advances in HIV care and treatment. We see about between 200 and 300 new HIV cases in the state of Wisconsin every year, which is low compared to many other states. And this is something that we can celebrate, but we can also point to programs like HDAP, which allow people to, again, maintain that undetectable viral load and stop the spread of HIV. And these are like, that is one of the best ways that we can prevent HIV is by treating people who currently have HIV so that it is not spread to other people.
If these cutbacks stick for a long time here in Wisconsin, are there other things that can kind of fill the gaps? Are there private services or things that hospitals offer or I don't know what that might help people who lose this coverage or who aren't available for it in the next couple of years under the Ryan White program?
There certainly are some options. So even in Wisconsin, right, Badger Care exists for some, but many HDAP clients are childless adults who are going to fall into a coverage gap. Their income is too high for traditional Medicaid, but there are no affordable insurance alternatives. There are pharmaceutical manufacturing assistance programs, but without the help of case managers to navigate those, they can be really difficult to access. The case management programs, I think, are one of the biggest challenges. You know, community organizations, I think, already struggle to be able to consistently fund those programs and support all of the people who need them. And while I'm sure that many of them would attempt to find other funding sources to support that work, I think those cuts would ultimately be pretty significant.
Now, the cuts in the kind of services we're talking about in Wisconsin and other states, as we heard from Jen, it's kind of a secondhand consequence of things like rising insurance premiums, rising costs of medications. Are you hearing conversations in the health community and maybe the health policy advocacy community saying, okay, with this new reality, with those higher costs, we should be advocating for more state and or federal investment to bump up the Ryan White program to meet those needs?
I haven't heard too much of that just yet, but I think one of the reasons for that is one of the issues that Jen pointed out, which is that for Wisconsin, those cuts that took effect January 1st of 2026 are for new enrollees or applicants into the HDAP program. And so people currently receiving coverage, that hasn't changed. Those cuts are all going to be in effect for current recipients of the program effective next January. And when we start to really see those impact our current clients on a broad basis, I think that's when those are going to be heavily felt. And there's going to be a lot more advocacy because we'll be able to see what that looks like. I think there's also an equity component here that's important to mention, which is that Black and Hispanic individuals are overrepresented among our HDAP clients because they historically have faced some of the greatest barriers to healthcare. And so, one, I think the fact that HDAP achieves 95% viral suppression across that population and includes so many people facing structural disadvantage is a genuine public health success story. And these cuts are going to put that very vulnerable population at risk. These are, in general, very low-income individuals, and again, overrepresented among people of color. And so I worry a lot about what the social and structural cuts to things like case management and mental health and substance use services will mean for those communities.
Dr. Quinn, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Catherine Quinn is director of the Center for Community Health and Intervention Research at the Medical College of Wisconsin. Earlier, we spoke with Jen Cates, senior vice president at KFF and director there of the Global and Public Health Policy Program. We've been talking about cuts to HIV assistance programs.
Coming up, a classroom with no walls in Sauk County. Find out why an outdoor learning program is taking off.
When I first started outdoor learning, I was very scared of like spiders. And by the time I was done with outdoor learning in second grade, I wasn't afraid of them. And I actually wanted to help them and not have other people squish them.
That's next on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Once a week, first and second graders at Tower Rock Elementary School in Sauk County enter a classroom that has no walls.
25 students, accompanied by three teachers, spend the day in their outdoor classroom tucked into nearby woods with a soaring sculpted bluff called Tower Rock in the school's backdrop.
Regardless of the weather, students follow a science and social studies-based curriculum on topics like insects, space, and practical lessons like how to dress smartly for the cold.
Nature-based education and outdoor classrooms are expanding in Wisconsin and around the country. The concept of teaching outdoors got a boost in the pandemic, but now, according to Natural Start Alliance, there are more than 1,000 nature classroom programs in preschools alone nationwide. That's up from just a few dozen a decade ago.
Prairie du Sac is home to one of these elementary schools. It's a community on the banks of the Wisconsin River, about 25 miles northwest of Madison.
Producer Mackenzie Crummy and I paid a visit to this public school to walk in the kids' footsteps outdoors.
You girls want to take us now?
I want to
get on the spaceship, Matthias.
Let's go to Saturn.
Ooh, should we go to Saturn and look at the rings? Okay.
A group of first graders at Tower Rock Elementary School are preparing to blast off to Saturn.
I'm ready.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1,
blast off! Oh my gosh! Do you feel the gravity force pushing on you?
The students are in an outdoor learning program. In small groups, they ride an imaginary rocket ship to the different planets, learning about their composition and place in the solar system.
Around Saturn?
Yeah.
What might we see as we're flying around Saturn?
Ring. It's a
bell. Oh, what might we see, Matthias?
Rings.
The rings. Do you remember what the rings are made out of?
The school only cancels the outdoor program when the wind chill factor plummets below zero. In all the elements, the students remain outdoors. But this isn't recess or free play. Every outdoor learning day is guided by a curriculum. And on this day, the students are learning how to build a solar system with Angus Mossman.
What can we say to help us remember the order of the planets?
My energetic
mother, my very energetic
mother
just served us nachos. Okay, what's the
Wisconsin has 421 public school districts. And according to the Department of Public Instruction, there are at least 17 schools that have a dedicated outdoor learning day. Tower Rock, which launched its program in 2021, is one of a handful of public, non-charter schools in Wisconsin with this learning model.
Tower Rock Elementary School is named after a giant sandstone outcrop bluff that's left over from 500 million years ago when this was all an ocean.
That is Angus Mossman, a teaching assistant and outdoor program coordinator at the school.
Sometimes we take kids up to the top of the rock and we call it the ancient beach because this used to be underwater. And we talk about how 500 million years ago, if we'd been up on top there, everything in the school would have been underwater and we'd be seeing all these crazy sea creatures would be inside of our school.
And there's three teachers work together to make the outdoor classroom a reality. They pitched the idea to the district, built a curriculum, and found local and statewide funding to help sustain the new learning model. Joanna Sorg has taught in the district for 15 years. She says an early connection to nature could help the children become good stewards of the environment for life and promote a healthy community for future generations.
So we try to instill that appreciation in them, but I think being able to visit all of these places really does help with that. It's more than sitting in a classroom and saying, well, we live in a beautiful area, you should protect everything. We go out there and we're like, look at all of this. You want this to be here for your family someday. You want to continue and enjoy this. So, you know, we need to work to take care of it. And I think that being there makes a huge difference in that.
Students at Tower Rock are learning about the environment right under their feet. They helped to restore a native prairie and learned about the federally endangered rusty patch bumblebee, which is rare but can be found in Wisconsin. Here's outdoor coordinator Mossman again.
It's one thing to look at bees in the classroom or teach about different kinds of bees and why pollinators are important. It's another thing to go out and overcome your own fear of bees and get next to them and catch them in containers and look at them and learn that, oh, male bees can't even sting you and I can actually hold this bee if I know what I'm doing. And that, oh, like now I'm developing a relationship with these, and now rather than in school learning, oh, yeah, these are important, and go outside and go, ah, I don't like bees, even though I know they're important. You say, oh, they're important, and like this is something I care about and I want to continue to care about and continue to exist.
Inside the school's sun-drenched open areas, there's plenty of outdoor clothing for any type of day.
Welcome to our gear.
And even a long row of rubber boots that is organized by size, thanks to Sorg.
So it's all stacked up on top of the cubbies where the kids store their own personal gear, and there's labeled things like
hats and socks. Mittens.
Sweatshirts. First aid. Extra clothes for wet and muddy kids.
Water bottles. Now we duck into a classroom to learn more about how this program works. I talk with Sorg and co-teacher Dylan Edwards.
My kids went to Montessori when they were little, and I feel like hearing Maria Montessori in my head, like when kids are out in nature, they learn their strengths. And I'm just wondering, like, what attributes do you think that they pick up when they are in the outdoors that they just can't get in a climate-controlled classroom?
Yeah,
So just the perseverance that it develops in kids and working through challenging situations, like you're out on a field trip and your gloves are wet and your hands are cold. What are you going to do? Right. And like working through that and problem solving and figuring out that you have to cross a stream and there's, you know, there's not a bridge. What are you going to do? How are you going to get across? You're going to have to step on those rocks. I also think it brings out really unique strengths in kids that help them with their peers. So we always have that student who struggles in the classroom academically, like academics are just challenging for them, but then they get outside and they shine, right? And they're seen as like this real leader. I can still remember one of the first groups that we had go through this program. We had a student who academics were challenging in the classroom for him, but when we went outside, there was one particular day where we were building snow sculptures and we were packing snow in buckets and like trying to make big snow forts and sculptures with it. And he had developed this way of packing the bucket and doing it just right so that when he flipped his over and took it off, it was like this perfect thing. And all of a sudden, everyone started noticing that he was the one who knew how to do this. And so everyone was like, oh, we need to try his way. And how are you doing that? And they were like, everyone was asking him. And you could just see that self-confidence and that look on his face and just what that did for him as an individual and, you know, just the power that it gave him among his peers to be able to have that opportunity to shine and have that moment where he didn't get a lot of those moments in the classroom during the day. So I think that's one of the big pieces is just helping kids find those greatnesses that might not otherwise be recognized.
I think another thing, too, that I like about it is there's so much of the stuff that we do that like takes all day or it takes a long time when there's so many things now with technology and screens where it's fast, 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 really short videos and things like that where it's on to the next. And this takes a long time to do some of these things and it takes teamwork to do a lot of these things that we're doing. And so kids have to slow down and understand like some things aren't going to be done in 5 minutes or in 5 hours or even days and weeks. This might be something that we do all year. And so I think for them to slow down and think you can still do stuff and have fun, even though it's not done really quickly and on to the next thing. So the teamwork and the patience and all of those kind of things I think are super important. And they get those throughout our days, too.
There may not be instant gratification oftentimes because they're so used to that on their screens and in daily life of getting that hit of, you know, instant gratification.
Exactly.
Yeah. What about students with special needs or neurodivergent students? What impact does this have on them?
So we last year had 3 nonverbal students between our 2 classrooms, and they participated fully in outdoor learning. One of the students had outdoor learning written into his IEP for 3rd grade as well because it was something that was so powerful for him, and he really found good regulation in being outdoors and just enjoying and observing and all of that. So I think that last year was our first kind of real experience with having some of those challenges, and we found a lot of success with it. Our special ed teacher was so supportive in making sure that everything that we were doing was accessible to those students, and we worked really well as a team just making sure that we put, you know, supports in place to make sure that they could be successful. We definitely, you know, had a few more adults join us on some of those field trips and things too, and couldn't have done it without them. But having that student that is still coming and joining us on field trips speaks a lot about what it did for him.
And I think we had another student last year that was also nonverbal, and when she started with us, just walking around the back hill, and granted it is a steep hill, but she would need assistance to go up or want to be carried up. And by the end of 2nd grade, she's with everybody. Like, she got so much stronger, and I think just like a lot more confident in herself and in her abilities, just in her own body. That was like a day and night difference between when she started with us to when she ended, and it was really incredible. And I think another cool thing too with those students is seeing how the other students that we have in class would really kind of rally around them and help them too if they need it. And so I think it was great on both ends for all the students involved to again work together, and for those kids to be seen as like not limited. They can do all the same stuff, and I think with having the teachers that believe in that, and then the students believe it too, and it was, I think, really powerful for those kids and for everyone involved.
Okay. I will. I'll sit right there. Head into the TV. Here I come.
It's
okay. Oh, it's so cozy.
What's your name?
Paisley.
You want to move in?
Paisley?
Yeah.
Oh, I love that name. It's so pretty.
My name is Kate. What's your name?
My name is Isla.
Oh, Isla. I love it.
Hey, first graders.
Hey, what?
One of our last outdoor excursions for the day is storytelling inside a teepee that the second graders made with branches cut down and hauled over from a nearby property, with permission, of course.
When Fish said, "Ah! What are you doing, Bear? Help! Help! Bear's trying to eat me!" No, Bear got started.
The story is a Native American legend about how the night sky came to be.
But he still wanted them to know a lesson, and so he decided he would take the blanket off of the earth for part of the day, but to remind the animals to be peaceful and to work together, he would put it back on for half of the day. And that is how the night sky and the stars that we see came to be.
An outdoor program like this is unique, and it requires a reliable funding stream. The teachers say it takes additional work to keep the program going. Each year, they apply for about $5,000 of local and state grants. They believe any school, in any setting, can make place-based learning a reality.
Whoa, what is all that? Tell me.
So, you have Uranus, Earth, Mars, asteroids, Sun, Venus, rocket, and Jupiter.
Well done.
Someone, what page are you on?
Now, some fifth graders have their younger siblings going through the outdoor learning program, including Brooks.
Because, like, now my brother's in that grade, I can help him out with stuff. Like, if he asks me questions when he gets home sometimes, like, we did this today, but, like, I didn't quite understand it, you know? So I get to answer those questions, and, like, other kids that know that I did it, they ask me questions, too, sometimes that I get to answer, which feels good.
I bet it's fun seeing your brother go through it and be like, yeah, I remember doing that.
My sister is in first grade, actually, so she's getting to do it with my mom this year as well.
And the outdoor learning is starting to become part of the fabric of attending Tower Rock. And the teachers are in the process of creating an endowment to have permanent funding for Tower Rock's outdoor program. Here's Mossman again.
I want kids to realize that this is a special place, and if people care about it, it will stay a special place. And if people don't care about it, it might not stay a special place. And so I think 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12-year-olds have it in their hearts to learn that, and that it stays with them for a long time. And I hope that someday in 50 years I'm out hiking around and there's people around here doing things to help other people realize that this is a special place.
So beautiful. Do you think your school is beautiful?
Definitely. That's 100% yes. Not a 99.9, 100. Maybe even 1,000%.
And thanks to Mackenzie Crummy for production work, Sarah Hopeful for sound design, and Angela Major for photos. Let's go out on lessons from outdoor learners. Here's fifth grader Bentley and then third grader Nash.
Don't give up just because your legs start hurting, because if you give up and take a break, it might not even make it better.
And if it's over your shoulders, that isn't a good walking stick, because it means you can't handle it.
And here's fifth grader Tenley and third grader Elliot.
When I first started outdoor learning, I was very scared of, like, spiders and, like, insects. And by the time I was done with outdoor learning in second grade, I wasn't afraid of them, and I actually wanted to help them and not have other people squish them.
I started out like, oh, no, it's so gross. Yuck, I stepped in mud. And then, like, as I grew up, I'm like, yay, I can explore this. I can see how much percentage dirt this is and how much water.
You know how the saying goes, one person's trash is another person's treasure.
Well, on Thursday, we'll find out how this applies to musical instruments. The Wisconsin Conservatory of Music is taking in people's unused and unwanted musical instruments They're refurbishing them and then getting them into the hands of kids.
Ahead of that conversation, we want to know, is there a treasure in your life that you found secondhand? Doesn't need to be a musical instrument. Tell us about what that item is, how you gave it some TLC and made use of it in your life.
We'd love to incorporate your story of finding a tossed out item and how it's impacted you. Email us at wisconsintoday@wpr.org. Or you can call or text us at 888-642-0232. Once again, that number, 888-642-0232.
Wisconsin Today producers include Lauren Cox, Trevor Hook, and Mackenzie Crummy.
Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Sarah Hopeful.
Learn more about us at WPR.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to WPR News.